Welcome to The Freshman 15, a film discussion podcast where we focus on the freshman works of 15 notable directors.
Here's what we do. Each episode, we talk about a different freshman film, what's good, what's bad, what themes and stylistics the director went on to use in later films, and what was kicked to the curb.
Also, we'll give you our opinion on whether the film still stands up, if it ever did, or if it's for completists only.
I'm Daniel Long, and once I was part of an elaborate kidnapping scheme in which I was the one being kidnapped.
And I'm Jeremy Bear, and I prefer if all photos of me be taken either straight on or 90-degree angles. It's how I look best, I feel. It's an aesthetic choice.
Yeah. Should we get started?
Let's do it.
Bob Mapplethorpe, potential getaway driver, go. Go.
Well, I think there's a real air of mystery about
me. Don't complicate it. Your number one strength is you have a car you can provide. Sell yourself. Start over. You ready? Go.
Okay. All right. I'm a risk taker. I'm growing an entire crop of marijuana plants in my parents' backyard. I think that shows
wait
a little
bit. You're growing an entire crop of marijuana in your backyard?
I'm just not that good at this selling yourself stuff, okay? So I'm just gonna tell you the truth. I really want to be a part of this team. And I'm the only one with a car.
That's good. That's good. Because that hits me right here.
Well, Daniel, episode 10.
Here we are, double dig.
We're soaring, baby. I didn't think we'd ever get here.
Wow. I don't know how to take that.
No, I thought.
I don't know. Okay.
I thought we would get here. I didn't know we would get here so soon, though. I will say that much.
Man, it's flown by.
Yeah.
And it's fun every time.
Yeah, it really is. I really enjoy it. Whether we're loving the film or, yeah, I'll admit it, whether we're hating the film.
Yeah, but it's not our fault.
That we hate the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, of course not. That's theirs. It's the dumbass fault of Kevin Smith and Sam Mendes. And
I thought we were done.
Okay, you know what? We can't be done because I felt a little, guilt is the wrong word, mm-hmm. but I felt a weight after we were done with that saying, you know, we acknowledged it in the episode. We've crapped all over Kevin Smith, the director, a great guy. Just as a filmmaker, we don't care for. I mean, there's no way around it. I can't apologize for that, but it's the truth. But I know that we have not really, that was not necessarily what a lot of our listeners wanted to hear.
Absolutely not. I've received actually a lot of text messages, either saying, I can't believe you hated the film that much, or I have to admit, I did go through a Kevin Smith phase.
Yeah.
As if they were confessing something.
Yeah.
And we did receive some feedback on the Facebook,
on the internets. On the internet tubes.
Yeah. A friend of mine from film school named Daniel Zana actually wrote us. And I want to read what he wrote.
Please.
So he said, I listened to this episode and man, was I bummed to hear you shit on all of his movies. Jersey Girl, fine, but his first three hold a special place in my heart. No mention of comic books or Star Wars at all in your review. I'm not a diehard KS fan as much anymore, but as comic book fan and nerd in general, I really enjoyed listening to Dante and Randall wax poetic about the random aspects of geek culture we may have all thought of but never said. I think there's some redeeming value to his work, and it's not as bad as you paint it. Also, pretty lame to paint all his fans as stoners. Give us a little more credit. Anyway, great episode and can't wait for the next one. Well, Daniel, thank you for that.
I think we should probably make a couple of concessions. Number one is probably unfair to paint Kevin Smith's entire audience as stoners. I'm sure there are plenty of stoners, but yeah, to say this is his whole audience, no, that probably isn't fair of us.
That's an overgeneralization. Though, I mean, to be fair, I think it's a large majority. Kevin Smith talks a lot about smoking weed.
I mean, didn't he even come up with that character Blunt Man or something like that? And that's his whole...
Right. So I know that not all of his fans are stoners. Weed, in particular, they're a big focus in the work. Now, one of the things I do appreciate that Daniel brought up, the nerd aspects, comic books, Star Wars, all those things.
Giving a voice to geekdom.
Yes, and I thought... And I take his point. That might not be a case for it being a good film, but I respect the fact that he does give voice to those things and that people appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's fair. I, as someone who is heavily into comics, films, I doubt I could name five baseball players. And not that these things are like diametrically opposed. I'm not saying that at all. But we did mention his comics and graphic novel material a little bit. Okay. And I crapped on that too. And I'll own that. But as I mentioned, I do own one or two graphic novels written by Kevin Smith.
Right.
And, you know, no, I don't like them, but
can't help yourself.
But the fact of the matter is, I have an appreciation for that world. Now, you know, could that have been done better than Kevin Smith does it? Absolutely. If anything, I actually have a little bit of envy for people that are able to have that kind of appreciation for Kevin Smith.
Really?
Well, in a way, because Kevin Smith's interests are my interests.
Okay.
You know, and right. I want to be able to engage with other people that share my interests, the fans of other people that share my interests. And, but there's this wall with Kevin Smith that I just can't seem to get over. So, look, I'm not proud of the fact that I hate Kevin Smith movies. I just, you know, I can appreciate that that doesn't make you, I'm not saying it makes you a dullard or anything like that if you do appreciate his movies. For me, I can't see it. I don't know what else to say.
Right. But if there's any point to this, it's, you know what? I don't, if you disagree, great. Let us know. Let us know what you're thinking. We will make you famous. We will make you famous on this podcast. Daniel Zana, who I might add is a filmmaker.
Is he really?
He is. He lives in New York. Great guy. Thank you, Daniel, for taking the time.
Daniel, I suspect you're a better filmmaker than Kevin Smith. So moving on, yes, it's true. We had an all-negative episode. You know, I think there was just something in the zeitgeist. The culture was dealing with an upcoming election at the time, and so there was a lot of angst. Thank goodness all that angst is over.
Oh,
we
yeah.
all feel terrific about how that election went.
Yeah, everyone's really excited.
Yeah, it seems to be nothing but optimism here, there, and everywhere you look. But you know what? We are all about the pendulum swing here at the Freshman 15. And so, yes, we went to the depthy depths, at least as far as Daniel and I are concerned,
right.
opinion-wise. When we talked about Kevin Smith, but let's turn it around, baby.
Yeah, let's move on from Hatesgiving.
Yeah, it's. I mean, after all, we're now in the. I mean, this is December. We're in the Christmas season now. It's all about optimism. So, for episode 10 of the Freshman 15, we decided to go with a movie that I'm just going to call it. We have terrific affection for, and of course, that is Wes Anderson's Bottle Rocket,
1996 film. This film, I'm gonna say it up front.
Go ahead.
It's gonna be really hard for me to say negative things
yeah.
about Wes Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
So this is gonna be one of those episodes in which I'm gonna be smiling the whole time because I can't wait to talk about Wes Anderson. But also, I have so much affection for his films
yeah.
and the way they make me feel. So I'm just saying that up front.
I'm going to go so far as to say that we're in episode 10 here of the Freshman 15. Mm-hmm. To date, this is my favorite film we've talked about yet.
Yes.
And that's really saying something because we've talked about some really great films, in my opinion.
Yep. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
It's my favorite of the last 10.
It's a journey that, you know, and I've mentioned this about other filmmakers with certain films that, yeah, you know, you appreciate it or you have affection for it. But there's certain films that you get on the other side of and you're like, I kind of feel lucky that I had that experience. You know,
mm-hmm.
I feel fortunate that I was able to take that in. Wes Anderson has a way of doing that. Bottle Rocket is no exception. As a general premise, how do we want to set up Bottle Rocket?
It's about three friends, primarily about Dignan, right? Dignan played by Owen Wilson. Now, the film starts with Anthony. You kind of get the sense that it's his story, but I really think that the film is about Dignan and Dignan wanting to incorporate his friends into these big dreams that he has.
Yeah, I would even go so far as to say it's Dignan's story as told kind of through Anthony.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And so Dignan is this childlike character who is really wanting to do something in the world. What that seems to be for him is to really be successful in a life of crime. And so Dignan is trying to elicit the help of his friends Anthony, played by Luke Wilson, and Bob Mapplethorpe, played by Robert Musgrave. And he is really wanting to get them involved in robberies, in these elaborate plans that he comes up with to live that type of life.
And it is, at the end of the day, a heist movie.
It is.
That's not new. Even a comedic take on a heist movie is nothing new. But there was something very unique about Bottle Rocket in that, yeah, it was heist and yeah, it was comedy, but it was also this sort of worldwide open, big-hearted take on people and friendship
yep.
and all these sorts of things. All these sorts of things that shouldn't fit into a heist movie, but yet there they are.
Do you remember the first time, yeah, you saw Bottle Rocket? Where were you?
Of course, I definitely remember the first Wes Anderson movie that I ever took in was Rushmore.
Okay.
That really hit me. I didn't expect it. I saw the trailers for Rushmore and I thought, oh, it looks kind of like a quirky mm-hmm. Ferris Bueller.
Totally. That's
you know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And then I watched it and I was like, wow, that's so much better than Ferris Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much more interesting and human and mature. And, you know, it just was more everything than Ferris Bueller ever could have been.
Was that in the theater?
Rushmore? I did not see Rushmore in the theater, okay. But I did see it, I want to say, it was not long before The Royal Tenenbaums was in the theater.
Okay.
So I caught Bottle Rocket. It was probably right after I caught The Royal Tenenbaums. Okay. So after I saw The Royal Tenenbaums, I was like, well, clearly this formidable talent that we need to pay attention to. A friend who was a director recommended, you absolutely have to see Bottle Rocket. I remember just thinking, I love everything about this. Mm-hmm. The character of Dignan was such a realized character that you know exactly. You're like, oh, I've seen this guy. I know this guy. But the strange thing is, I had never before that seen a Dignan in any movie ever.
No, I know. It's so unique to that film.
Yeah, and somehow it just built the story around Dignan. I don't know how else to put it other than it just made so much sense. And that's a funny thing to say because there's so much sort of off the wall and so much abstraction in the movie. But the more you go into the story, you're like, oh, that makes sense. That makes so much sense. Not just story sense and plot sense, but it makes heart, human, feeling, beauty, love sense. And I'm sorry. I know that's just a gush and I apologize. But it just, it rang so true with me in a way that there isn't another filmmaker that can quite do that. And I was in love with it.
Yeah. The thing about Dignan is there's a level of innocence, and yet he's so sure of what he wants. He maybe not be sure about how to get it, but he's so sure about what he wants. When I watch Bottle Rocket, every time I am so envious of Dignan.
Yeah,
I want to be like Dignan. And I don't. And maybe we actually want the same thing, which is this just to be who we are in ourselves. Maybe we don't go about it the same way.
Right.
But I always want to be him. I love the character so much because I'm like, man, I want to be that honest. I want to be just that open and that comfortable with who I am and myself.
Let me tell you about this job we're
gonna... I got this program and I'm trying to stick to it now.
Okay. Just hear me out. It's called Hinkley Cold Storage. Here are just a few of the key ingredients. Dynamite, pole vaulting, laughing gas, choppers. Can you see how incredible this is going to be? Hang gliding. Come on.
What about yourself? When did you first see Bottle Rocket? How did it hit you?
Okay, so I saw it not too long after it went to DVD. What was the theatrical release? I know it bombed, but I'm not sure when. 96 must have been when it was released theatrically. But when it went to DVD.
So there was no other Wes Anderson movies when you saw it?
No, and I rented it. Because I thought it was a heist movie in the typical vein of heist movies that I'd seen. I thought it was going to be like a thriller. I mean, on the cover of that release are three guys with guns.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be awesome.
And I remember that release. It was written in this sort of like speed font and the whole thing.
Yes. And so I rented it, watched it, and I was floored by it. But I don't even know if I could say like I loved it. I just know I watched something I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And so I actually kept watching it. So there was like, I rented it and I watched it multiple times. And then I would ask friends to come and watch it with me because I was just didn't know what was going on, but I loved so much of it. And this is the thing about Wes Anderson's, and at least how I approach them, is I need to watch them over and over and over again to kind of get a sense of the story and of the people and of the characters and all the different details. And Bottle Rocket isn't as detailed, but it rewarded me for all of those rewatches over and over and over, even that first film.
It was clearly a new voice that was on the scene. And for those who don't know, Bottle Rocket, the film, was based on a short made a couple of years earlier by Wes Anderson and his friends, you know, the same actors. But it was a black and white short, kind of a small section of the movie where, you know, we see Dignan and Anthony, they're robbing a house, and we find out later that it's actually Anthony's
such a good move.
House. Yeah.
Love that.
And, you know, and of course, the some of the different conversations and fallout from that. Now, that's a tiny part of the feature film Bottle Rocket. But apparently, Disney saw the short and they said
they loved it.
Yeah, we need to be in the Wes Anderson business. So James L. Brooks decided to take Owen Wilson and Wes Anderson under his wing and say, you need to make this into a feature film, expand this into a feature length screenplay, which I think they worked on for, I think even just the screenplay they worked on for a good year or so. And supposedly, their first draft of it was, it was going to be like a 4-hour movie or something like that. And James L. Brooks said, look, you need to understand some things about how all this works. But they made the feature film. It did not do well with test audiences. And of course, it eventually found this cult following.
I know.
And thank God, because, in Wes Anderson, the world of film was given a gift, a unique voice, a new voice that's been copied, but not really ever duplicated,
no,
I don't think.
I don't think so. And I think that for all the things that maybe Wes Anderson has quote-unquote stolen from, French New Wave and other old films, people can't do that successfully with his films.
You're right, and I say that actually from experience. I shoot, we've talked about this in a few different episodes, I direct ads and commercial spots, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. I've had shoots where I've said, we're going to do this whole thing like it's a Wes Anderson film.
So that's like a thing you can say and people know.
Well, yeah. And that's if they amazing. Don't, then I tell them.
Right.
And I've run one or two shoots this way where I'm like, this is going to, where we're going to shoot this in a Wes Anderson style. And I show them the storyboards and they groan because it's hard. It is. It's hard. It's hard to shoot that way. And you wouldn't really think that. I mean, I'm talking more about the visual aesthetics, not necessarily like the...
No, but that's what I want to hear. So yeah, when you say that we're going to shoot this in Wes Anderson style, what are you referring to? And why is it so hard to duplicate?
Okay, so like for example, we shot a short promotional piece for a company that I decided I wanted at least the visual aesthetic of Wes Anderson, which is a very controlled color palette in a very specific way, but more specifically, the angles that we were taking on everything.
Okay.
We're very, I said, we're going to get rid of all 3/4. Everything has to be either dead on at the subject, mm-hmm. or profile at the subject, or directly behind the subject. And that's so much harder than it looks. And one of the biggest reasons is because of reflective surfaces.
Oh, okay.
So when you are in a situation where you're shooting everything dead on and you can't kind of angle your mm-hmm. camera at all, it's very, very difficult to light that. And it's also very, very difficult to hide the camera from, any kind of reflective surface or any kind of shadow or something like that. It's just you have to do so much troubleshooting in order to get that to work. It's not worth it. For most directors, forget it. I mean, yeah, that's a cool aesthetic, but I'm not going to go through all the work to make that happen. If I can get 3 times the coverage in one day by shooting in a certain way that most people are fine with anyway, yeah, I'm going to do that. I just don't need the headache. Wes Anderson just isn't that kind of artist. He says, no, I have a specific vision of how I want this to look and how I want it to go. It costs what it costs, and it is what it is. And so that's and you just know that if you're part of a Wes Anderson shoot, that's how it is. And that there is something just incredibly inspiring about that, because movie sets are expensive. They really are, and it's not a pressure-free environment.
No
and
way.
I guess that's probably obvious to say that. When you have studios and producers and all these people breathing down your neck and saying, you need to show us what we're paying for, and not at the end, you need to show us as we go, what is this thing that we're buying? And you're overcomplicating a shoot that should be very simple.
Right.
That doesn't fly. And so it takes such resilience and tenacity in order to be that committed to that difficult an aesthetic. And that's I take my hat off to Wes Anderson for that.
Absolutely. And you can tell he has a vision in mind. And in particular, what I love about the way that he shoots things is there's just so much always in a particular frame.
Right.
And I would imagine that's one of the reasons why it might cost a lot, because he wants to get as many things, people, in a specific shot, whereas another director might cut to someone, they don't need these people, we're going to do these shots now, we'll bring those other things in later. No, he's like, I want it all in now. I want every frame to be a piece of art, every frame to be a photograph that you can put on your wall and look at and be in awe of.
And I think that's truer with each film as it goes. Now, Bottle Rocket was his first.
Right.
If you were to do like this chronological kind of montage of Wes Anderson moments, you would see that Bottle Rocket was the least realized aesthetically. But even that is really saying something, because just divorced from everything else in Wes Anderson's body of work, It is a pretty real, aesthetically realized film. I mean, it's actually incredibly well designed. It's just not as Wes Anderson-y as he would get later. But man, I mean, he had such a visual sense right from the get-go. And you can see that in really every frame of the film, I think.
I think you can too. And I think that, and that's what's so great about revisiting the film in light of this discussion, was having seen all of the things he's already done and then going back to Bottle Rock and seeing, wow, he started here.
Yeah.
Those insert shots that you see all over the place in Bottle Rocket. That wasn't something that he thought, oh, this would be cool to do later. No, it was there from the beginning. Even in the short, in the way that he could film it, you can see those insert shots. I think it's fascinating how much more realized his aesthetic became from the short to the feature film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that there's so much there that I'm like, wow, what happened between those two things for him to be so sure? Yeah, this was good, but I kind of want it to be this way.
That's true. There are moments that you see in Bottle Rocket. You can see the genesis of the Wes Anderson aesthetic that's been taken to, I mean, you know, as we sit here in 2016, his most recent feature film is still, of course, The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is this aesthetic smorgasbord.
Oh, I mean, beautiful.
I mean, you look at it and you're like, how do you make every frame an oil painting?
I know.
Like that. It's astonishing. And no, there wasn't that sort of eye-popping, jaw-dropping art direction quality to Bottle Rocket per se, but there's moments.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see in those moments, like you said, the inserts. Clearly, there's, you know, when you see the Bob Mapplethorpe gently picking the keys up off the table, and, you know, you see all the, you see like the confetti and all the other things all around. And that's a Wes Anderson moment. When you see Anthony running through the hotel, mm-hmm. looking for Inez.
Yeah, said it's all right.
And it is shot in that very sort of 90-degree angle sort of style, that whole sequence. And it just feels very designed, even though it's like this kind of heart-pounding moment. Everything's so designed about it. I don't know. I envision Wes Anderson taking those sorts of shots back into editing and saying, next time around, let's do more of those.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, let's see how far we can push that. And, you know, and pushed it so much farther in Rushmore until by the time you're at Royal Tenenbaums, it's like, no, we're only doing these kinds of shots and that's it.
Yeah, I think we have a question that we often ask here in the podcast, which is, you know, what might the director leave behind? And it's harder for me to answer that because it just seems like the things that he decided to continue, that's just what he does. He's just kind of taken the things that he loved, or you can tell that he loved in Bottle Rocket, the things that made it unique, and said, okay, exactly, we're going to do more of those.
Right.
And so it didn't even almost seem like a conscious decision of, I don't really want to do that anymore. More like there's just not any room to do any of that because I only want to focus on this.
Yeah. I mean, there are cuts that I see in Bottle Rock, and by cuts, I mean shots, that there's just no way he would do them anymore because he just doesn't. Yeah. Like you said, he doesn't have room and they're just not part of his master plan anymore. Honestly, there's only one moment in the whole movie that takes me out of it. It's toward the beginning. It doesn't last long. It lasts for like 3 seconds. And it's a shot where Anthony's talking to his little sister.
Okay.
And they're doing like a little back and forth. Yeah. And then there's just like there's an over close close up of Anthony and an over close close up of her. And then it's back to the story. And it's so un-Wes Anderson that you just feel like, ugh.
That moment took me out too. It's funny that you mentioned that. Watching it, I'm like, oh. Wow. And it actually made me see things or wonder about things that I hadn't thought about. Like, oh, was his hair different? His hair seems different.
It's a weird moment because not only is it over close and all that, the color correction is slightly different.
Maybe
on that shot.
Okay.
And there's all these weird things wrong with it. And it still mystifies me. I'm like, how is that in a Wes Anderson movie? But then you kind of shrug and you move on because everything else about it is so great. But no, that by the time Rushmore came along, no way is that happening anymore.
Yeah. And the cool thing about this film too, even working maybe in the budget that he had or just given what maybe the actors were wearing, is you still have this uniform. I mean, the characters are still in quote-unquote uniform like you see throughout all of his films.
Yeah.
Whether it's the turtleneck or whether it's the...
The high waters.
The high waters, the jumpsuits, or Robert's glasses and his overcoat. You still have it right here at the beginning.
Well, to me, with Wes Anderson films, this is part of what makes him such an impressive artist. There's two tracks that everything... I mean, there's more than two, but there's two basic tracks that he is completely and utterly unique. On the script track, on the characterization and all that kind of stuff, and the type of story that he writes.
Right.
No one really writes like that. Honestly, that in and of itself would be enough to define Wes Anderson as a completely unique artist that's going to be remembered forever in the history of film. And then you have the sort of visual and aesthetic track that's so completely, completely other than everything else right. that's ever been done really in film to a degree. It just to be that committed to that aesthetic. And if he only did that, that would be enough to make history for that. He would always be remembered just right. for that. But it's the merging of the two that makes it like almost otherworldly that he's able to do this. And I think I even mentioned this back in the David Fincher episode. I could be wrong, but there's a number of filmmakers that you can look at and, you know, you can watch a scene and you go, okay, that's so-and-so.
Right.
Only Spielberg would do that. Only John Woo would do that. Mm-hmm. But there's a much, much shorter list where you could see a single frame
yeah.
of the film and say, that can only be them. I would put Wes Anderson in that category. Like you can see one frame of the Grand Budapest Hotel and say, that can only be him. You
that's
know?
Him. Yeah, you're right.
There's no other filmmaker that can even shoot that as a still. That's Wes Anderson. You know, of course, Wes Anderson doesn't just shoot feature films. He shoots ads and commercials and stuff. And we'll link to a few of those. And even in these short sort of moments, you know, you're just like, yeah, that's, I don't know what I expected mm-hmm. this to be, but that's a Wes Anderson perfume commercial. That's a Wes Anderson Stella commercial. Right. You know, it's just that has to be.
So what do you think the aesthetic is doing? So, yeah, I'm curious to know your thoughts on what it serves for every frame to be painted in the way that it is. The stories that he's wanting to tell, because I do think that the style serves the stories, but it's so hard for me to think that he wouldn't have the style no matter what. We can't divorce those two things. Yeah, what is that style doing?
I think that of any filmmaker I can think of, there's no filmmaker more divorced of cynicism than Wes Anderson.
Right.
That manifests in a number of ways. I see that as, first of all, in the stories that he likes to tell. There's something that was true in Bottle Rocket that, in fact, it may have even been truer in Bottle Rocket than any of his other movies. I might take that back. He looks at the world like he's a 12-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. If a 12-year-old boy could remake the world, what would he make it into? And I know that's such a specific thing, but it's hard to arrive anywhere right. else, especially when you see something like Bottle Rocket. When you see a character like Dignan, of course he rides up on his dirt bike yes. to try and get Anthony to join his heist. And of course, you know, when they get all this money from this first job that they pull, they run and they buy a bunch of fireworks and start blowing them off. And I even think of that moment when Dignan and Anthony are talking about how they're going to, now that Bob took their car away, how they're right. going to get transportation after that. And he says, well, you know, let's go into one of the rooms and steal the keys or something like that. And Anthony says, no, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think we can do that.
I know we can. It's real simple. We go into another room.
Dignan, I'm sorry, but it's not even a possibility, okay?
Then we're going to have to hotwire a car. And this idea, I don't back down from. This idea.
Yeah. Like, he's so sure. And yeah, when you're 12, when I was 12, I remember, you know, I remember thinking about that. Like, okay, what would a life of crime look like? Yeah, you know, you're hotwiring a car. Yeah, I would buy fireworks and yeah. dirt bikes and the whole thing.
When you get angry, you throw a rock through a windshield. I mean, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not even just Dignan also, but it's just like, if you look at the whole relationship between Anthony and Inez.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's a 12-year-old fantasy, honestly.
Following the girl around the hotel and.
Yeah. Even the sex part of it mm-hmm. is this sort of naive idea of sex. Mm-hmm. But the weird thing is, it's no less authentic though.
I know.
Even as an adult, it's just as mature and affecting as the most sophisticated love story you'll ever see. Now, I say all that to sort of bring it back around to the aesthetic. There's this embrace of innocence, mm-hmm. straightforwardness. There's just no cynicism at all in the aesthetic also, in my opinion, because there's something that's so, from the color choices that he makes, it's a drawing, it's a finger painting. You know, I don't know what it is. It's the colors that he chooses in these angles. There's almost this kind of naive quality to it where it's like, I want to show two people talking. Why wouldn't I just point the camera at two people talking? Why do I have to have crazy funny angles? And why do I have to add drama and stuff? I want the conversation to be the conversation.
Yes.
I want them to be standing next to each other or then one in front of the other. And that's it. What's wrong with that? Yeah, it's gorgeous and it's designed, but the philosophy underneath it is so, it's just, it's an embrace of that innocence.
Yeah, I think you're right. And even thinking about the short and then thinking about the feature, you know, in the short, they're talking, it opens up with them talking about Starsky and Hutch. And it's in the middle of a conversation. And then you have in the films, the language, the things that they talk about and the way that they talk about them. Yeah, you could imagine young boys having that type of conversation.
Yeah.
Describing things the way that they describe. I mean, even the way that they fight. There's this moment when Anthony lets Dignan know that he gave Inez the last of the money. Dignan is just, he's so angry, he throws the rock through the windshield, but then he just can't do anything but lay on the ground.
Right.
And then Anthony goes over there to talk to him, and Dignan just swipes at him with a screwdriver.
Right.
That moment is so affecting for me because it's so violent,
yeah,
but just so reactionary.
Yeah.
Here are two friends, like you would imagine two young kids getting in this fight, getting angry at one another, and they're not thinking about what they're doing. He's just going to take a swipe at him, and he does, and it doesn't matter what he has in his hand or how he hurts his friend. And there are so many moments like that in Bottle Rocket, but all throughout his films, that really point to this level of kid-like feelings. I mean, his films feel like storybooks in that way.
Yeah, I mean, there is something about it where it feels kind of like not only is Dignan the most kind of interesting and defined character in it, there's a weird sort of side to it where it felt like Dignan kind of wrote the script too, you know,
right.
And because it's not just Dignan that has that kind of quality, because that's another thing. We've kind of seen those movies too, where mm-hmm. there's, you know, there's a weirdo who doesn't quite jive with everyone else because he's a little more less mature or he's got his own kind of vibe going and stuff. And it's like, oh, all right, let's have the straight man play off the weirdo. But in the Wes Anderson world, Dignan's not the weirdo.
Right.
In fact, Dignan is just another character in sort of the Dignan flavor of telling stories. Because you make no mistake, whether you're talking about Anthony or Bob or even Mr. Henry, played by James Caan, they all have that kind of like, what's the pre-adolescent boy idea
yep.
of what a Mr. Henry would be like or what a country club would be like
yeah,
or
karate,
something like that.
He knows karate.
He knows karate. Yeah, and when people come to visit him, he hides up on the roof and pours water on their
for
heads.
Sure.
Like, what is that?
Yeah. And then you have the he sticks up for Bob, you know, against the bully in the country club. That is empowering, like that moment.
Yeah, and that's great. Bob, I love Bob as a character. Bob is so great.
He's so good.
I knew I would love Bob the first time I saw the movie when Bob wouldn't stop fiddling with the gun.
Yes.
One of the greatest, most hilarious scenes there is because the scene doesn't go the way it's supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen that scene in a movie that ends with, go ahead, motherfucker, say that thing that you just said one more time.
Right.
Say it. And everyone just kind of bows their head because the alpha has spoken in the room and everyone moves on. But it doesn't work that way with a bunch of 12-year-olds.
Man, how much bullets does this thing take?
Bob,
man?
Look, please, I'm paying attention.
God damn it!
Anthony, just keep the gun on the table.
Keep
Dignan, relax.
I can't focus unless the gun is on the table.
We just paid for it.
Shut up, man. Shut up. I'm warning you now. Be quiet, please. It's true, Dignan. I paid for the gun.
Say it again.
Say it one more time.
Say it again.
Repeat what you just said.
I paid for the gun.
He's out. You're out too. And I don't
calm
think I'm
down,
in either.
Okay, just calm
no
down.
Gang.
I mean, it's just so good.
It's perfect. Everything's perfect.
And then
it
makes the reconciliation so beautiful. Because then, you know, Anthony goes and talks to him in that scene, and then he comes out and I just really want this to work. I mean, I love that.
There's no bigger heart in film than Anthony's.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone else writing and directing the Anthony character, I would hate that character so much. I would be like, I can't watch this. It's too twee.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take it. But in Wes Anderson's hands, Anthony is the salvation.
Yeah.
You know, he really is. He's the salvation. He's Dignan's salvation again and again. Even in this climactic scene at the end where they're trying to figure out who's going to run back in for Applejack. And Anthony, of course, is just like, Dignan, come on, just go. I'm going to do it. And Dignan says, give me this one.
Yeah.
You got to give me this one. You got to let me go back in there and get Applejack. Come on.
I got to fly solo on this, baby.
Okay, Dignan.
I don't have time to argue with you right now.
I don't have time either, okay, Dignan? Now, you get back to Bob's. Just go.
Who is in charge here?
You are, you dumb son of a bitch. Now, please leave.
Give me this one. Give me this one. Gotta give me this one.
Dignan, you know what's gonna happen if you go back there.
No, I don't. I never catch me, man. Because I'm fucking innocent.
And you can see when Anthony lets him do it, that's not Anthony saying, all right, fine, good. I guess I get to escape then.
Mm-hmm.
That's Anthony taking pity on Dignan and saying, I can see that you need that.
Yeah, and he gives it to him. Oh, man, that is such a good scene. They'll never catch me because I'm fucking innocent. It's so good.
So great. And by the way, may or may not know this, but of course, the movie was not received well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that led to the Bottle Rocket's cult following was Martin Scorsese put out a list of what he considered his top 10 films of the 90s, mm-hmm. and he put Bottle Rocket on there.
What?
A lot of people looked at that and said, Bottle what?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's Martin Scorsese saying, yeah, Bottle Rocket, Wes Anderson, one of the 10 greatest films of the 90s. So a lot of people went back and said, okay, well, apparently I need to look at this because I don't even know what you're talking
right.
about. Yeah, apparently they even asked Martin Scorsese at one point, like, what was it, you know, and he talked about it, but that was one of the things that he said. He said one of the best written lines, they'll never catch me because I'm fucking innocent.
Oh man, it is so good. It just says so much about the film. It says it in a way, even if it's talking about something larger, right? This Dignan character, given this world that Wes Anderson has created, it's okay for it to be there. You don't ever think like, oh, okay, well, that's a little on the nose giving us this idea of who this character is. No, because that is what Dignan would say.
Yeah.
That is how he would think in that moment.
Yeah. You can analyze it and you can put poetry behind it and all that. And it still works if you do.
Yeah.
But even if you don't, it's such a perfect character moment. You can't replace that moment.
You can't.
You know, there's something else. I know I said there's two tracks. There is a third one, though, that I can't forget because it's just as important. Oh. As important as it is.
Can I guess?
Go ahead.
Music.
Music.
Yes.
Exactly. Music. It's Wes Anderson movies have unforgettable music.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, the early films of Wes Anderson were scored, including Bottle Rocket, by Mark Mothersbaugh, who you probably know better as the guy from Devo. Which is hilarious.
Yeah, it really is hilarious.
And it also have a, you know, Mark Mothersbaugh, of mm-hmm. course, is an Akron, Ohio guy, just like me. And that makes me very happy. But there's this kind of quality to it that I will say that he doesn't use Mark Mothersbaugh much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It bums me out in
yeah.
some ways. Every single film has a great score. But there was something about the quality of those early films. Those first, I don't know, was it four films that Mark Mothersbaugh did?
Yep. I think he did it all the way up to Life Aquatic.
Yeah. Man, it's just, it's this weird sort of light quirk pop mm-hmm. thing. We've already talked about the fact that I don't know music labels as well, but that's it. It's got that quality to it. And man, oh man, even leaving all that out, he chooses these songs that could only be in Wes Anderson movies. Well, let me go back on that. They were only in Wes Anderson movies until people started trying to copy Wes
yes.
Anderson. And now it just seems like every third movie has a song by the Kinks or the Rolling Stones yeah. in it or something like that. But don't forget, this was a Wes Anderson staple. Was this certain kind of like, he loved British Invasion
yep.
and he loved all that kind of stuff. And it just, if you buy the soundtrack of any Wes Anderson film, you're going to listen to it 1,000 times.
Yeah, and then you won't forget if you see them in the films, especially some of those songs over the montages. I mean, those are the things that just come to mind when you hear those songs. Yeah, when I was just thinking about making films or writing films, Wes Anderson made such an impression on me that I couldn't help but want to listen to those soundtracks, to get into Cat Stevens. I mean, after I saw Rushmore, and I wanted to listen to so much of Cat Stevens. After I saw Royal Tenenbaums, all of a sudden I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I need to listen to Nico. And
mm-hmm.
man, he creates a certain world. He creates a certain tone, a certain feel through the music that he uses. I'm glad you named that track because you really, if you took those out of the films, I mean,
yeah.
you'd still have remarkable films with great stories and something wonderful to look at, but they do add an element that we can't overlook.
And that's the thing that I'm always so mystified about with Wes Anderson is, I don't know how else to put it, how does that happen? How does a person have an aesthetic so fully realized? Now, he credits Hal Ashby, Mike Nichols,
right.
Truffaut. In fact, moments from The 400 Blows are all over
yeah.
Bottle Rocket, in detail moments mm-hmm. all over the place. And by the way, if you've never seen The 400 Blows, please do. It's a great
French
New Wave film.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can see that. And you can see that in, you know, in shots from The Graduate, you know, the underwater stuff. And you can see that, you know, you can see Harold and Maude material and certainly in Rushmore and some of his other films. He has his influences, but that's what they are. They're influences. He's not really aping anyone. He just says, oh, I kind of like that, how that made me feel. Instead of just copying it, I'm going to Wes Andersonize it. And I just don't know how something that specific happens that fully formed in one guy. It's a mystery to me.
I know. And I think one really key moment in Wes Anderson films that kind of proves your point is the end of The Life Aquatic, when Steve Zissou comes upon the jaguar shark, which is such an amazing moment. And he uses Sigaros for that moment.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really cool thing, because it really is about tone. It really is about feel. And it's not just, well, what 70s song can we put in this, you know, because it's what I do. No, it's how do I want people to receive this moment, and what's going to serve that musically. People, when I talk about Wes Anderson films, even if they don't necessarily like all of his films, they always go back to that moment in The Life Aquatic as something that moved them deeply. And they're not even sure how or what to do with that.
I wonder if it remembers me.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just one of it. And I could point to really any number of them. In every movie, there's something that's so pointed and moving about it that I don't know what else to do. Maybe I am a teary guy. I didn't used to be, but I get moved to tears by so many Wes Anderson moments, and that's one. I wonder if it remembers me. Ben Stiller saying, "It's been a really hard year," during the mise-en-scene shot at the end of the Royal Tenenbaums. The dedication of Max Fisher's play to Edward Appleby, a friend of a friend. You know, I even talking about them now, I get emotional, because these moments are not just really heartfelt moments, but they turned into a thing that was a part of me, you know, in a way, because I thought I just, seeing that is so true to me, and that's now a part of who I am.
I'm glad that you talked about those things, because that was one of my questions for you, is like a favorite Wes Anderson moment. When I think about that, you named it already, but it's been a rough year, Dad.
I got your new dog for the boys. I just bought him. You did? Sorry I let you down, Chaz. All of you. I've been trying to make it up to you.
What's his name?
Sparkplug.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've had a rough year, Dad.
I know you have, Chazzy.
Every time that scene comes, I get emotional. I mean, it does make sense, but it's hard, because you have this idealized world that Wes Anderson has created, in the sense of its structure and the way that it looks, but yet such unidealized people. Like, they are who they are. And I think that is one of the things that I love about Wes Anderson and his characters, in particular the protagonists of the films. Even within these worlds that look so perfect, he's dealing with these elements of imperfection, of actual humanity. Relationships for him aren't perfect. It's not like they end with these perfect relationships. What actually has to happen in these films, and what does happen, is people receive and accept one another for who they are.
Right.
And that, to me, is so interesting, given that he creates these elaborate worlds, and yet you have these very human stories where it's not about a person becoming perfect or wonderful or great. No, it's about, we're trying to do this thing. You're my dad. You're my brother. You're my sister. Let's figure out how to live together, given who we are.
Yeah. I feel like there's something before we get into our kind of like our final couple of discussion points. There is one thing that I feel like the discussion would be incomplete if I didn't bring it up. It's the fact that Wes Anderson is actually a polarizing filmmaker. Mm-hmm. He has, I mean, it's almost an understatement to call them detractors, because there's people. I talk about them like this is National Geographic or something like that. There are actually people. No, but in all honesty, there are people that absolutely hate Wes Anderson. Now, from very early in his career, the Criterion Collection decided that Wes Anderson was going to be one of their filmmakers.
He's a voice they want to keep alive.
Now, you know, for those who don't know, the Criterion Collection is invested in the history and the art of film. And so, you know, when you see like a release from Criterion, it's like, it's essentially them saying, this is a film that we want to make sure is not forgotten, because it's too important to the culture of film and the history of film. So there's basically a release of every Wes Anderson movie. It's very very interesting, though, because being someone who belongs to the Criterion, you know, message boards and all those kinds of things, whenever a new Wes Anderson movie, it lights up. I mean,
people go crazy.
People come out of the woodwork talking about how he's a hack and he's terrible and he's, and then they'll name every other filmmaker in history who deserves to be ahead of Wes Anderson. I don't know. I feel like that kind of has to be brought up because, I don't know, what do you think that is? Why is it? What is that oppositional reaction in so many people that Wes Anderson seems to inspire?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do have friends, too, that actually name Bottle Rocket as his peak moment and that he's gotten worse. So it's hard for me to divorce the question that those people in my brain from the question you just asked, because it does seem as if it's connected to these worlds he creates. It seems like I think people have this sense that he's only really concerned with these details or these really quirky things without necessarily having any substance or anything to say through them. And so I think for some reason that keeps people at a distance from his films.
Yeah.
Whereas with Bottle Rocket, you don't have that. I mean, you have some of that, but really everything is really relatable from the things you look at and the things that you see. His films do, in terms of visuals, become less and less relatable. And so I wonder if that's what people are kind of attacking, just saying, well, he doesn't really care about the story. What he cares about are these images that he's putting up on the screen.
Yeah, I bet that's part of it. I mean, when I read some of these comments, they say things like, it's twee, it's overly sensitive. I see phrases like, you know, the delicate flower that is Wes Anderson and all this kind of stuff.
Really?
And they say in this, like, this kind of mocking
way.
I mean, yeah, you got me. They are delicate films. I don't know. They're big-hearted, delicate films. I don't personally get that cynicism, applying that kind of edged cynicism to a Wes Anderson film. It feels like, I mean, I hate to say it's missing the point, or I hate to say something like, I think you're just watching the wrong movie.
Right.
Because that's kind of easy, you know, and in the same way that people could say, tell me, you're just watching the wrong movie when I'm watching Clerks. And that's fair to a degree, but there's also a part of it where a criticism is still a criticism. And, you know, well, it's just not your kind of movie. I'm not satisfied to land there with Kevin Smith, and maybe I shouldn't be satisfied to land there with Wes Anderson either. I can't really get myself in that mindset, though, with Wes Anderson. I don't know what it is.
I think it comes back to something we talked about in the Baz Luhrmann episode. Here's a filmmaker who isn't afraid of being hopeful in some way, isn't afraid of talking about relationships and love and people interacting, and isn't cynical, as you already described. I think people can make the argument that Wes Anderson is overly sensitive, maybe because his stories deal with things that are like that. But I do think that there's an element of people aren't willing to suspend their version of reality to enter into his, which you have to do. With a Wes Anderson film, you actually have to suspend your understanding of how people talk, of the things you're going to see. If you're not willing to do that, then you're not going to laugh. You're not going to actually be drawn along in the story that will ultimately make what makes me feel deeply.
Right.
But because from the very beginning, I'm able to do that, I allow Wes to take me on that journey. And I think that's it. I think people, they want one foot in the boat and one foot sort of out of the boat.
Let me hang on to my cynicism a little bit, though, because you can't take that from me.
Right, exactly. And so they're not willing to go all the way. And of course, I mean, at that point, it's like, how can you engage in that story if you're not fully invested in it?
I mean, you know, I know we kind of joke around, and we were talking about Hatesgiving last time and all this kind of stuff and, you know, Kevin Smith and let's get our catharsis out. But right now, joking aside, we live in a world that's kind of in trouble. People aren't loving each other the best right now. And I don't know. I mean, at the risk of sounding naive, I guess, this is the time for Wes Anderson, in my opinion. I think this is the time to remember family and love, and maybe even naively and innocently to a certain degree. I think these films mean more to me now than they ever did in some ways, because that's the painting of the world that I want to be a part of. Even though, Bottle Rocket, I realize, is what we're ultimately talking about. I know we've been talking more about Wes Anderson than Bottle Rocket, but even in the context of a heist movie, that's the undergirding there. It's that big-heartedness. I mean, just, it doesn't really have anything to do with, you know, stealing cash from a fish factory or whatever that place was.
Right.
It has to do with these relationships, and that's where the gold is, you know? And I guess you could say that's true with just about any heist movie, but I mean, I guess in particular, I feel that way about Wes Anderson.
Whenever I watch a Wes Anderson film, he makes me want to be a person who truly is able to see another human being and to be a part of relationships that are honest, but are also willing to accept people for who they are. I mean, one of my favorite moments in Bottle Rocket is at the end. Bob and Anthony go to visit Dignan. Bob is talking to Dignan because part of the story is Mr. Henry, actually, because they do this heist. Mr. Henry, played by James Caan, he ends up breaking into Bob's house and stealing all of his stuff while they're all away at the heist. And Bob has this brother named Future Man, also a Wilson brother, played by Andrew Wilson. So when they go to visit Dignan in prison, Dignan's asking him about all of this, and Bob says, you know, he has this moment where he's like, you know, me and Future Man are actually getting along better.
Yeah, but, you know, in a strange way, it's brought me and Future Man closer together. I mean, we went out to look for a new piano the other day, and he looks at me and he says, Bob, just because you're a fuck-up doesn't mean you're not my brother. That kind of touched me. You know, he didn't normally open up like that.
That moment touches me.
Yeah.
And I should probably be offended, or I should not be. Maybe I should be more mad that Bob isn't offended.
Yeah.
But he received that as love.
Yeah.
And he receives that as his brother trying.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what I see in a lot of Wes Anderson characters, is they get to the point where they're trying.
What's partly great to me about that moment is that's a comedy line.
Yeah.
But Robert Musgrave, I don't know whether it was he was directed this way or it was just a choice he made in an actor, is he sold it as the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
He sells that line with weight and importance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wes Anderson saw that in editing and said, I'd rather have that story than the laugh. That's a big deal. I think that's the staple of Wes Anderson. I know we've been talking about different Wes Anderson moments and all those kinds of things from different films. Where do you put Bottle Rocket in all the Wes Anderson films? Where does that one rank?
So this is hard. It is really hard for me to rank Wes Anderson films.
Yes, it is.
I'm going to actually put it, for me, at number 3.
Number 3, okay.
I'm not sure if I can differentiate films that were important to me at a certain time and it being a good film. There are films that are really important. Like Bottle Rocket was a really important film to me. And so I think that there might be other Wes Anderson films that are better. But for me, it goes Royal Tenenbaums, Rushmore, and then Bottle Rocket.
Yeah.
And I thought so much about this order. And after that, I could, if I worked on it, I could probably find an order. But that's where I think Bottle Rocket sits. It sits up there for me.
Yeah.
It's just so good.
Yeah, it is. It's a solid film.
I'm
not going to put it that high.
Yeah.
And maybe part of it is because it was not the first Wes Anderson film that I saw. To me, there's the three. It's just, I just don't know what to do with the three because they're not just my three favorite Wes Anderson films. But some days I feel like if I'm making a list of my top 10 favorite films, maybe all three of them would be on that list. And of course, that is Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, and The Life Aquatic. I think that whichever of those three that I'm watching is my favorite movie of all time. You know, while I'm watching it, that's my favorite film.
Right.
I can't stop smiling through Rushmore. Like, I'll catch myself. I'm like, I've been my cheeks are because I've been smiling this whole time. I think Royal Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic would probably, one or the other would need to take the top spot. I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent slightly more time with Royal Tenenbaums, so maybe that one. I don't know. I love Bottle Rocket. It's not my favorite. I would say probably the least essential, if you can say that. I even hate saying that. The least essential for me Wes Anderson film is probably Darjeeling Limited.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah. Great film. It's the only one that I probably think the script maybe could have used a little bit more of a pass, but you know, I even hate saying that because it's a great film. Even though it was awards wise, probably the most celebrated, was Grand Budapest, is, you know, it got nominated for a ton of Oscars and all that kind of stuff. I love the film. It's not among my favorite Wes Anderson either. To me, Bottle Rocket sits kind of probably in the bottom half, but it is in that course kind of, you know, Moonrise Kingdom area.
Yeah.
Which I, you know, another one I love. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, I'm just going to say it right here out loud. If you want to know what Sam Chakusky is going to look like when he grows up, Daniel Long.
Yeah, I take the cake on that one.
It's true. I mean, you can't really even deny it.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we should do a side by side.
We should. We should do that. I'll do it. Let's go for it. Man, if only I had some sort of like Boy Scout uniform.
I know. Don't tell me you don't. You never were in Boy Scouts?
No.
Shoot.
Were you?
No. No, but it surprises me that you were. What does that even mean? I don't know. You've got that like always prepared kind of look.
Oh my goodness. If you really, you know, I'm going to take that as a compliment. No one has ever said to me, you kind of have, you seem like a guy who's always prepared.
You seem always prepared. No. I've seen you get up front in front of hundreds of people. You look like you're ready to go.
Oh yeah, for sure. But don't ask me to start a fire or tie a knot.
Or stab a wolf in the
woods. No, I can't stab a wolf in the woods.
You can't do that.
No,
all right.
I can't do it.
Whatever the case, though. Yeah, but it's in that area. It's in that sort of Moonrise Kingdom, Bottle Rocket, Grand Budapest. That's kind of the area that I would put it in.
You know what's fascinating to me? People, when they talk about Wes Anderson, this is my experience in conversations. When people talk about Wes Anderson, they actually say, oh yeah, Moonrise Kingdom, I actually kind of like that one. For people who don't like Wes Anderson, for some reason, connect with Moonrise Kingdom. And I wonder if it's actually, if it proves the point or speaks to our point about Wes Anderson being very childlike.
Like it gets a pass in that case because it's actually about children.
Yes.
Okay.
It just came to mind.
No, it's interesting. I think that's probably legitimate. You know what? I've heard people say the same thing about Fantastic Mr. Fox because that's obviously aimed at an all ages audience. And that's another one I just love. I mean, I love them all. I can't.
It's hard to, if you look, it's funny. If you were to look at my list, I have 1, 2, 3, which I already named, and then 8, which is Darjeeling. And I don't know where the other, I mean, it's just, they're all so, yeah they're all so good.
It's just a bunch of good movies. Of course, you know, the final question, does this film stand on its own or is it for completists? I'm going to say yes and yes, because yes, it stands on its own, but you should be a Wes Anderson completist because every single film deserves a watch, a rewatch, your full attention. I'm going to go so far as to say every film is not just worth a watch, it's worth a purchase because it's the kind of thing that should be in
our
DNA.
Yeah, it's art.
Yeah.
And I would, just to go back to what you said earlier, Jeremy, this is not only a film that people should watch, I do agree that this is a time, a season for Wes Anderson. So for those of you who are listening, you're like, I don't know, I don't really connect. Give it a shot. Allow yourself to enter his worlds. And then afterward, if you feel like there's still something lacking, okay, I get that. It's not your type of film. But until then, until you're willing to suspend that cynicism, that sense of, I don't know if I believe this or if I buy this, buy it and see where it takes you. Because I think this is a time when we need these types of films.
It's not accidental. And this is something Daniel and I talked about at some length. It's not accidental that we're doing the Wes Anderson episode right now. In the same way, there wasn't accidental that we did the Kevin Smith episode last time. I said, all cynicism, all joking aside, I think this is the time. I feel like I kind of needed it in a way, you know, because whenever we do these episodes, it's an excuse to get back into the oeuvre of that particular director's body of work. And it's been a stressful time. I've been having a stressful time lately, and I needed some kind of perspective on it, and it really helps. It helps me.
Yeah, it helps me too. Do it. Let us know what you think.
Well, I think that's it for this episode of the Freshman 15. We want to thank you for joining us. I'm sure it's painfully clear by now, and if you're not a Wes Anderson person, this has probably been doubly painful for you. But for Daniel and for myself, Bottle Rocket, absolutely see it. Any other film by Wes Anderson, absolutely see it. See it again. Take as much from it as you can. Be grateful that we've got a filmmaker like Wes in the world.
And if you want to reach us to tell us about this episode or even to recommend a freshman film, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram. You can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. And also, if you have a quick moment to give us a rating on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it. It helps with the Google searches so that people can find us. So if you can do that, please, that would be awesome.
A rating would be great. A review would be great. We have a couple of them up there, and thank you to those that have written reviews. Also, thank you again to Daniel, not you, Daniel, but Daniel who wrote in about Kevin Smith. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Daniel.
We really are interested in your feedback. I also want to mention our friends over at Steelcraft. Born of a desire to see people come together over food and drinks, Steelcraft unites local eateries with a communal dining space in Long Beach. For more information, visit steelcraftlb.com.
And just real quick, Steelcraft is actually going to be opening up in a couple weeks, so please be on the lookout.
Do we have a date on that yet?
We don't have a specific date, but I did hear from the brains of the operation that it will be in just a couple weeks.
Exciting times. All right.
I'm Daniel Long.
And I'm Jeremy Bear. Thanks for listening.
Tell Anthony I love him.